Welcome to Books, Stories, People with me, Nancy Richards. Every day since the 1st of October 2020, Jean Duplessis has cycled, often with other riders, sometimes alone, all the way from Newlands Forest to the King's Blockhouse on the slopes of Devil's Peak, a punishing ascent on very rough track. Well, the ride has been dubbed Blocktober, but he's been doing the route daily ever since, and as he heads for his 100th ride on January the 8th, he's clocked up more than 50,000 metres of climbing over 2,000 kilometres in about 150 hours. He's doing it in part to draw attention to the plight of victims of sexual assault, one in particular, and to date he and his fellow riders have raised over 14,000 rand for the Saki Bartman Centre for Abused Women and Children in Manenberg. But this is not the only challenging journey Jean has undertaken in his career. Currently land specialist with UN Habitat's Land, Housing and Shelter section and based in Nairobi in Kenya, he's travelled and worked extensively all around Africa, Europe, the East, Timor, Haiti, Iran, Nepal and elsewhere, in each place taking photographs that speak volumes of the individuals living there. But during lockdown here in Cape Town, he took the opportunity to compile some of these images into a book called Why Are You Looking at Me? Each image accompanied by a short, poignant piece of prose. You can find out more about Blocktober and about his book on his Facebook page, Jean Duplessis. We can contact him directly at duplessisjean7@gmail.com. Well, I caught up with Jean in Newlands Forest to find out first why he's been doing the blockbuster rides.
When I came back from Nairobi, where I'm based, for the lockdown period, my friend Jonathan Anser told me about a dream he had of renaming October Blocktober, a little bit like Movember and all those others. And for years he's been punting this with friends and everyone has walked away. And I just, yeah, let's do it. And then on our rides, we discussed why would we do it. And the idea was then to ride from Newlands to the Blockhouse and back every day of October. And then we earned the right to rename the month. So that was essentially the idea. And then we were thinking of a potential cause to attach it to. And gender-based violence was just the obvious choice for us.
So I just have to draw attention to the fact that we're sitting in Newlands Forest right now. We can hear the crickets, we can hear the birds, we can hear the wind in the trees. Is it, I suggested that it's quite a punishing ride, but is it lovely? Tell me about the ride itself.
For a mountain biker like me, it's fantastic. It's just 1.5 hours of riding. You can do it early. You can go straight to work. It is as tricky bits. It is steep, 500 meters in about 9.8 kilometers. It's quite a climb, but it's a good ride to do now and then. The challenge we put to ourselves was doing it every day, rain or shine. Twice we had mechanicals. Once low down, we walked the bike up to the top and down again. So the idea was we will do this come what may. Got a bit harder, and I must say by day 90 the body and mind are quite weary, because it's just, there's never a day's rest, you just keep on doing it. Yeah.
So you're enjoying it, you're clearly fit, you're a cyclist and you love what you're doing, but I think that you're being driven by something more than that. It's for the cause that you're doing it. Tell me a little bit about that. Why gender-based violence?
It's kind of grown into this as we went on. I mean, I'm riding with very good friends. Sometimes we were 8 people on the... We got very excited when we reached the height of Everest, which now seems a long time ago, and we had a little party and so on. And it was mostly men, actually. I think only 2 women have ridden it ever so far. And I think that was appropriate because trying to struggle with this thing that is one of the worst scourges, actually, one of the more universal scourges in the world, and particularly in South Africa, where the statistics are horrific. And then there's a personal case which I know about and am part of that has been drawing out for a long time, and it gave me a way to meditate on that, actually. And the metaphor of riding up a mountain every day, I mean, if there were days where the southeaster would be waving the bike like a flag in the wind, where we were holding on. There were days when it was really cold and really quite dangerous to do, and we kept on doing it. And that metaphor taught me quite a lot about resilience and solidarity. And that's what's kept me going anyway.
Is it, obviously you've ridden it on a number of occasions by yourself, is it something you think about a lot as you're cycling? Question A. Question B, is it something you think about a lot?
Cycling is my thing, actually. I mean, I'm not a top cyclist. I don't win races unless I'm one of the only three in my age category. Then I'll get on the podium. Cycling has always been the place for me. And in Nairobi, Karura Forest is right next to our compound, so I'm there every day. It's the place where the world makes sense. If I've got to think something through, it's a rhythm. It can be very beautiful if you're not commuting through polluted streets. And so it is that rhythmic thing where you can really think through things. I mean, some days, of course, you don't think at all. In fact, you can't remember whether it's today's ride or yesterday's ride. Come around a corner and think, have I been yet already today, you know? But it is the place where you can steal your resolve, as they say, and build your courage, and or just take out your frustration on a particular bit of hill. If you attack it, it's going to win. But you can get some sort of get some anger out of your system, I think, would be a thing. And also, this has been for me a lesson about the long haul and a lesson about what must it be like to wake up every day with this thing hanging over your head again and again, and having a very high and then suddenly you have a low and you can't choose. And I was actually saying to my family that if this had been a ride that started down and ended up, I'm not sure I would have been able to finish it. For many people, that day is one that you start down and then you have to climb at the end of that. This is one where you get the most stunning view of the city and you just cruise down and you're home for a croissant and a coffee or so. So I wonder if someone that switched it on me and said, now you living in the blockhouse going down and up, I'm not actually sure it would have been as easy or as doable, yeah.
I suppose it's a bit like life, isn't it? You talk about your resolve, and I think your resolve has been very inspirational for a number of people around the world. I'll get back to that later, though. I just want to think a little bit about the gender-based violence aspect. Is it something that has always made you angry, and does it make you angry now?
It's a tough one to be. I mean, firstly, gender-based violence is not just directed at women. So it's something that could affect me personally, although the chances are much, much less likely, of course. It just seems to be the ultimate violation. And when you know someone who's gone through that, and I know quite a few people, there's a particular person that I'm focusing on, then you can only be there in support. You can't do it for them. You can't even do it with them. You just have to be there. And this has been part of my way of being there, of just being present and saying, all right, that's what's happening for you. It's not as difficult, it's not as bad, but I'm climbing this hill. So it was more instinctive as a thing, and it has been really appreciated. But I have to say, at some points, I got worried that me doing this and maybe getting ill would add to the stress of the person concerned. And I try to make very clear, this is not on you, this is on me. I'm doing this essentially for me and my own ability to conceptualize how this thing works and whether and how it can be resolved.
I guess it's a risk worth taking, because at the same time as you're doing this challenging thing for yourself, you're also raising awareness. And it's something that, if I can say generally, men prefer not to think about unless they are perpetrators or victims.
Well, this part has been fantastic, and I've been on a bit of a high the last number of days, because I'm approaching the 100th ride, which is on Friday. So we thought, I have done every day. A number of my friends have been with me for many of the times, but I've persisted every day. And I have an international community, particularly in Kenya, where cycling is huge, and I have many, many friends. So I reached out and said, why don't we do an international solidarity ride on Saturday, day 101? And I don't know how many people will make. You know, in Baltimore, where I have one particular contact, will be 1 a.m. People in London, that would be dark and cold. So what we've said is you don't have to ride, you can run, you can walk, you can do it inside, you can do it on a trainer. Just try and do it at the same time as us for 90 minutes and we'll be together. And I've had fantastic support. And then the messages come from people. This is not just about cycling, this is about this thing that actually bothers all of us. And that's been fantastic. And then also we managed to raise a little bit of money and it's a drop in the ocean. But then you get these wonderful requests from someone in Tunisia saying, how can I get money to the Sarkit Bartman Center in Cape Town? Our message generally is find a local place and support them. What is it that we say? Listen, learn, think and act is the kind of mantra that we're working with. Keep it local. You don't need to send money to SA. There's enough resources here that we can try and raise. But that's been extraordinary. And that community has been mostly men, and many women, of course, but men saying, yes, we think this is a good thing, which has been great.
So people around the world on the 9th of January, people around the world at 8 a.m.?
Yeah, it's the Kenyans asked for 9, so they got the preference because most of my contacts are there. It will be 8 a.m. here, and then whatever hour people calculate on this. That does not mean that old Nick in London is going to ride at 3 in the morning. He'll probably do it at his 9, which is fine. I mean, it's just this symbolic thing. We're asking people to take photos and send those in. We don't want to over-organize this. This is just about people feeling that they're doing this thing together. There's not much publicity to it or anything like that.
What do they say? Bad news gets published and good news just happens, and this will just happen right across the world. It's very exciting. You say that there are plenty of resources here in South Africa for places like the Sarkit Bartman. I'm not so sure. The Sarkit Bartman has been going for a good number of years, seen many thousands of women going through their doors. It's a very, very special place. And for you?
I was inspired by meeting them eventually. We were trying to look around. It was an interesting little story on media. I heard about them, heard very good things about them, went onto their website, and the last posts were 28, and I thought, oh, this is like died or whatever. That wasn't true at all. Luckily, we knew one of the people on the board, indirectly contacted her and said, no, that was one of the first things we cut when our money ran out to keep the web. We're doing okay on Facebook, but we can't afford at the moment. And of course there are resources. Just go into the streets and look what people are driving. People are struggling, but there's always spare resources that can go. And places like that, I'm not picking on them as a particular institution, but any place like that, Rape Crisis, Sarkit Bartman, any place of refuge that can support. I think the number under correction, I mean, the number was over the years, they've been going for 21 years, am I right? You can look up the number, but it's a huge amount of women and children that have been helped through the years. And they don't just provide refuge. It's a whole rehabilitation thing. It's support in the courts if there are court cases. And it's also advocacy throughout. So I think any organization like that that's local deserves to be identified, linked with, and they want contact. They don't just want money and then be given some resources.
This is the humanitarian in you speaking, isn't it? But just going back to the cycling, as you were talking about what you think about or what you don't think about when you're cycling here, I think in terms of your book that you've produced, you have done a great deal of thinking about it during your cycling around the hills and valleys of Kenya.
Kenya is an extraordinary... East Africa is an extraordinary place actually to visit. It's a heady mix of legal, extra-legal, illegal energy that is just so amazing. And many, many people who go there pick it up that this is an interesting place. The cycling community there is fantastic, and the off-road riding has been a revelation for me. So when I went in 2012 to start my current job there, I started interacting with some of the cyclists. I mean, Chris Froome originates from Kenya. His first trainer, David Kinja, is still there now. And it was my entry into Kenyan rural society, going through very humble places, staying over there and cycling. So it's been much, much more than, it's not about the bicycle. But what's interesting about bicycles in settings like that is you are non-threatening arrival. It's extraordinary. If you were walking, it would take you forever because of the distances. If you were running, it would be strange. And also the distances would be intimidating. You come in a car, you are insulated, you are dusty, and off you go. Everyone knows why a bicycle is coming into town. Kids run and they greet you, you buying some cold drink, and then off you go. And it's been an incredible way actually to learn about East Africa. It's been good.
And there's a lot to be learned about East Africa and many more places, for all the places that you've traveled to in your book. Your book is called Why Are You Looking at Me? What did you have in mind when you were cycling around the hills and vales of Kenya thinking about this book? What did you want it to be?
Well, I'm now 59, turning 60 next year, and I've been taking photographs since I can remember, since my first work that I did in Queen's Mercy area in Transkei. And photography has always been part for me of the interaction with people and places. And so for me, it's been really about how, is there anything in there that is worth telling or recording? Also part of my exasperation at what's happening in media with photographs and words, that they become digital, you can't get them back. Truth is becoming much more elusive, very difficult to fact check, and photographs also just become, you see them just being churned out, you don't even know whether what you're seeing is real, the colouring is seldom real, and so on. And so in my thinking about, all right, so what have I done? I went back and located the 30 photographs in the book now, I think I had about 70 on a wall. And I tried to work out, I'm not the greatest photographer in the world, there's some good ones. I'm not the best writer in the world, but I can write. What can I do to bring some kind of thread through of what I've done since I started working in the early, you know, since 1989, basically? And then I found pictures which I liked, and that's sort of, and I got completely stuck. And of course, while I was cycling, I was thinking, and of course, what happens is you find the brilliant phrase which you forget by the time you finish. That's another interesting part of it all. But I was assisted by a very capable, became the editor. Just to anecdotally, I gave him a present for his 40th birthday. He turned 60 last year, I think. And the present was a series of pictures with captions. And ever since then, we've had this conversation. But there was a very heated, really, exchange at one point involving a couple of us in a room in Kenya, actually, all the photographs on the wall. And the challenge was from my wife, actually. She was saying, what is the story here? What is the thread in the story? And I didn't have an answer. And so what David, then the editor, had mentioned earlier in the conversation is a saying that is attributed to Ernest Hemingway, I think, which is the six-word novel idea, which is attributed to him, but I think it was actually an advert in the window, which is baby shoes, comma, for sale, comma, never, no, sorry, baby shoes, comma, never worn, comma, for sale. Six words. And there's the mystery in there, there's the drama, there's the whole thing. And so what I then did over a period of, long before lockdown, was I challenged myself and said, if you can't find six words to describe the essence of the photo, of the image, even if it's the greatest image, it's out. And so the walls slowly separated in my house of the ones where they were. And you'll see now in the book that every caption is six words, and the title is six words as well. Why Are You Looking at Me? And so eventually I found 30 pictures where I had the six words, and then I tried to add other reflections on. And that's how the thing came. And essentially, I mean, having been in the privilege of having been in so many situations, my main focus is on land and the right to adequate housing. And in the process of having the privilege of being in all these, even two locations in Iran and in Timor and in et cetera, et cetera, I have had opportunity to engage with such extraordinary people and places. And then this gave me the way to try and show that in some way of what it meant to me.
You say that you're not the greatest photographer, but you have got a lot of soul in each and every one of the pictures. What is it that makes you take a picture? Is it an individual? Is it the individual within its lands, within their landscape? What is it that makes you hit the button?
The first photograph that I use in there, the caption is, "Hey, Mr. Photo, there he stood," or something like that. "Hey, Mr. Photo, there he stood," six words. The last caption is, "Why are you looking at me?" And when I arrived in Timor after some years in the Department of Land Affairs, I went there on an assignment and eventually started working for the UN there. People were so hungry to have their images taken because cameras had been forbidden under the Indonesians. News wasn't getting out. Journalists were being killed. And then suddenly here was some kind of hope that things would be better, and people demanded to have their picture taken. And that particular photograph, I had taken a picture of a Che Guevara drawing on a wall, some kind of mural, and he saw me. I was walking back to my vehicle and said, "Hey, come," and he composed the picture. And, you know, for me, there's that. I try to never take a photograph of anyone who wouldn't want to be in the photograph, unless they're doing something evil, then I would. And so it was that kind of relationship between me and the person in that moment. Because he just walked off. When it was done, he didn't want money, he didn't want a print, he just wanted the picture to be shown. And so that was, in a sense, that interaction has taught me to not just arrive in places and do my work and leave, but to try and engage in different ways. You know, there's the other one, which is possibly my favorite of all, Maurice Johnson sitting on a bench within a mile of Barack Obama's desk in Washington, where I'd been listening to stuff from the high table in the World Bank conference for 5 days. There was a cold snap coming. The headlines in the papers was, "Will the cherry blossom survive the cold snap?" And I just saw the homeless prepare for this cold that was coming with plastic on benches and et cetera, et cetera. And I was very distraught, actually, and cold myself at that point, thinking, how would they, what do they do? And then a voice from the right said, "Please, sir, can you help me?" And that's, again, 6 words. And I saw this guy, and I just went and sat next to him. I said, "You tell me what's going on here." And he told me his life story and the medical crisis which led him to be homeless, etc. Twice. The same story, twice. He went through the story just to make sure that I got it. And then I said, "Well, what is this about a cup of coffee?" And he said, "If I've got money for coffee, I can go into McDonald's where it's warm. That's how I survive the cold snap." And so it's that kind of growth that one gets from a proper interaction with someone, where the camera, and then at the end I said, "Can I take a picture of you?" And luckily, with a terrible phone camera, I got a very nice image of it. So those are the kind of things. The last one, well, you'll have to have a look at that yourself, but the last one has no text attached, and it's just, "Why are you looking at me?"
Gosh, so they're listening photographs. They're photographs where you have listened physically or mentally or visually. You have listened to what people are saying. You talk about the first young man who organized his photograph in front of Che Guevara. He didn't really want a print or a picture. He just walked away. But I think you are at some pains to make sure that you do take prints to each and every person that you photograph. Is that the case for everyone?
Well, that was the ideal, and it still is. And in fact, the other favorite one of the kid running with a tire in the hills, that photograph was delivered by my friend Alex Tabuta the other day. You know, so I do try that. It was a principle in those days, and we had turned Guy Tillum, who is a real photographer, he stayed with us on the farm near Matatiel for a while, and we turned the milk room into a dark room and so on. And there my idea was that I interact and I take the pictures back. But it can become a bit of a loop, because then you take a picture of the person getting the picture, and then you could be stuck. But it has to be, life has to be more than just passing through if you're traveling in this way. I mean, the cost to the environment and to your employer's account, etc., of traveling, we're discovering now with COVID how much you can save. We're sitting with unspent budgets, huge unspent budgets, because we're not traveling. If you're going to be traveling, you have to link with what's there. You can't just go and sit in a room and talk to people and leave again. And I think that's been, when I'm in places, I'm not frugal, but I don't spend money because I walk. And that's where you get these engagements. So in Mashhad in Iran, I try to find a park, and the one that I found had a fence around it. I couldn't get in, and that was my story. You know, so it's not always people, but it's about, what am I doing here, and what is my role? It doesn't make sense for me to have been on an aeroplane, sometimes even business class, not often, but, you know, all of that stuff. And the seminar room and the talking voices and the et cetera. doesn't make sense for you to be there. Now, the photograph's not going to make it make sense. But it's part of that question of what are we doing here in trying to fix the big problems that there are.
I think the expression is take only photographs, leave only footprints, which is a mandate that you seem to be working on. You know, you mentioned the six-word caption, which in some cases it was expanded to a considerably more, not considerably more. So you start with six words. At what point did you know when to stop? How much story did you want to reveal?
Well, I had the wonderful David Schmidt as my editor, and he's so strong in saying, show, don't tell. And that is hard. And I mean, the interesting thing about this whole exercise is often the story is not even in the frame. The story is in the context of what I was thinking on the day, you know, and what was happening to me at that time or so on. So it is a little bit about also what is outside of the frame and how am I interacting with this place and this moment. Photographers will explain to you that really great photographers, maybe 10 or 15 moments that they capture, these are those ones that you know, the iconic pictures. No words. The photo does it. For me, words would have to come in. But it was, I mean, sometimes 15 lines became two. Not just through editing, but through rethinking and rethinking. And it is, I mean, my trade as a capacity development person, getting people to formulate the essence is very much part of a basis of learning. If you can't get it down to how you understand, how the person understands it, teaching it becomes useless. And I'm a very big fan of action learning and a student of action learning, which is where the assumption is the answer lies in the person presenting the problem, not in the expert coming in to explain it. And so what is your process for helping that person through open questions to come to the realization of what to do? Because if action, as Reg Rivens, who's called the father of action learning, always said, you can't have action without learning or learning without action. And so how do you help the person to see the insight? How many sessions does it take to get to that point? This is what I'm going to do next. And I think that's a little bit of the basis of my thinking around quite a lot of this stuff is what is the essence. But as you say, some of them are not short, so I'm not going to give people the expectation that's all very concise. Some of the things are very complicated and they don't seem to be answers, but yeah.
Less is more. And as we speak, a plane goes overhead without you on it. Just lastly, on the subject of less is more, you have self-published, less is more, quite literally, you have only published, I think, a very limited number of the book of Why Are You Looking at Me? You hope to publish more, but you've published it under the title of Lonely Staircase, which is one of the images in the book. Tell me about the Lonely Staircase.
Yeah, the board meeting of the Lonely Staircase Incorporated publishing company was virtual and lasted 30 seconds because the first resolution was to close the meeting. I mean, we were joking, really, in a serious way. We wanted it to be a thing that is published, and we've done that. We got a very, very capable designer to help us, and it was so that it exists during lockdown. I won't have time to be doing this, you know, once I go back to Nairobi, and it's there. The question now is, where do we take it? The Lonely Staircase is almost a lockdown story. It was an image taken from a taxi in Dakar in Senegal of a spiral staircase standing possibly for sale. I don't know. I had seconds to press the button and it became the sort of iconic picture which has no words to it at the end of the book. But my wonderful daughter Anna got us during lockdown to do these creative arts evenings, which I am not an artist of any kind, but we were doing lino cuts. And so I did a liner cut of the Lonely Staircase, and that became the print that became the logo. So that's the story of the Lonely Staircase. Maybe the Lonely Staircase will become one of these massive international corporations one day, who knows, but not on my watch, it won't.
So finally, Jean Duplessis, cyclist, author, if anybody would like to know a little bit more about you, about the cycling, about how they can get hold of a copy of the book, how would they do that?
That is a very good question. We are busy trying to find a way to... Let me say it like this. This is a niche book. And I think there's a niche audience that would want to find it and see it. It is beautiful to have. You want to hold it in your hands. I'm not about to send it out virtually quite yet. And we've had an initial print run of 25. We're planning a bigger print run than that. We're talking to some bookshops about possibly hosting it directly from us instead of going through the usual channels, etc. We'll see how that goes. But we will try to crowdsource a bigger printing. My dream is to launch this with an exhibition, actually, of the photographs. How do you do an exhibition virtually? These are all questions we're all struggling with. But the best for now would be just look at my Facebook page, Jean, spelled like Jean, J-E-A. In Duplessis. I'll happily allow you on, and I'll post something on there that indicates to get hold of me, or then through Messenger, if that's good enough.
That's more than good enough, and thank you very much, and very best of luck for the 100th ride coming up. And if anybody would like to sort of celebrate post the 100th ride, I'm sure they can, and I'm sure your spirit will be with them.
Thank you very much. We're asking people to, on Saturday morning, if anyone hears this before, Saturday the 9th, 8 o'clock, just do 90 minutes of exercise. You can walk, you can run, you can be on your trainer, or come right up to the blockhouse. You'll find us there around about 1 hour after 8 o'clock this coming Saturday. Thank you.